How can humanity express the archetypal thought of absolute in its pristine form? This is a question given to us by one of our monks here in the Absolute Monastery. This is Dr. Herbert L. Barley, Dean of the University of Healing, bringing you the Absolute Philosopher. How can humanity express the archetypal thought of absolute in its pristine form? Well, the question begs a lot of information. Humanity cannot express its archetypal thought of absolute in its pristine form because humanity is unable to define absolute in any form at all, much less the archetypal thought, much less in its pristine form. Now, pristine form and archetypal go together. They are consistent with one another. But how can humanity express the archetypal thought of absolute? Let's just look at that for a moment. Humanity cannot express the archetypal thought of absolute in any form. Humanity, by its very definition, is relative, and by its very definition is changing, by its very definition is an illusion that has no reality about it. It may tend toward a real experience, but it does not. It is not a real experience. Humanity is a constantly changing, constantly responding series of atoms that are circling around as our physical body or in our physical life. We think a thought, we think wind, and then there's the wind. We think house, and then there's the house. We think car, there's the car. We think body, there's a body. We think fat and thin, there's a fat and thin body. We think dishes, there are dishes. Everything we think becomes, but it is nowhere near its archetypal form. It is nowhere near its ideal form, its concept. The concept of spoon looks quite different from the spoon. The concept of spoon, I don't know what it is, do you? The concept of spoon may carry out this contact, and it's a matter of something that picks up something, but it's not really archetypal. Because, well, let's just separate the two for a minute. With humanity, with humanness, relative role, we create a limited activity. We create a limited experience for whatever is involved in it. And whether it's man or animal or ideas or whatever it is, it's always limited. In absolute, there is no limitation because there is nothing there. Absolute is the nothingness and the allness, and it has no changing form. It is a concept. And as a concept, it does not grow or decrease. It does not enlarge. It does not change. It doesn't become better. And it doesn't become worse. It is just whatever it is. Now, if you were to look at the concept of the absolute or the archetypal, you would not recognize what it portrayed. You would not recognize what it represented, because I would say, in absolute, after giving it considerable thought and listening very closely, all of the things that I've ever said in the past about absolute are not correct, because I was thinking of absolute relative to the relative. And every time I made a statement, it was based on the relative, and therefore it was it could not be. It could not be. Because absolute itself is just transcends anything that we've ever had. When the Buddha was in bliss, and he came back from his nirvana experience, he couldn't explain it to anybody. He had no words to describe what bliss meant. And the saints, when they are spending years and years and years and years seeking out a blissful experience, when it strikes them, they have no definition for it. Now, let's just look at the biofeedback program, which gets us about as close to bliss as you can get. The biofeedback teaches us to recognize a feeling when our emotions or when our physical body or when our thinking system is at its peak, as we understand it, its peak of oneness. We feel a bliss. We feel, we don't even know what bliss is, but we feel bliss. We feel absolutely good. We feel just magnificent. We feel, wow, this is, you know, it strikes you. And there's no words for it. There's no picture for it. There's nothing. We just feel it. And if we feel it off an octave or up an octave, you know, then we're not in the ballpark, but we're close, but we're not there. And until, well, let's just take the singer. Some call it soprano is an excellent voice, just an excellent voice. And she sings up a storm. And when she hits some of her high notes, the vibrations are the same as the vibrations of a champagne glass. And bang, bang, bang! The champagne glasses all break because she has arrived at that synchronistic vibration, which the champagne glasses have. And she's just popping them off like popcorn. And this has happened. This has happened. It is a rare person to do something like that. Now, some men have a very tremendous low range in which they cause things to rumble, you know. Their voice just sets a vibration up of tremendous rumbling and all the dishes are, you know, like shaking on the table and making all sorts of noises. That's rare too. But that's vibration. Now, what I'm saying to you is those vibrations get near to the vibration of not a blissful thing, but a blissful type of thing. When the biofeedback teaches you, when you feel in deep meditation, you just feel in a blissful meditation, which you can't describe, and you know that the vibratory tone on your biofeedback machine is singing a certain melody at that time, and you try to duplicate that in your mind, which you can do because you've experienced it once or twice, that gets you close. But why is it the biofeedback equipment didn't catch on? It did catch on because those who were excellent meditators found it very beneficial, very helpful. But most people are not excellent meditators. They don't take the time to do it. They don't take the training. They don't take anything else. And maybe it doesn't take time or training. Maybe it just takes an attunement, you know, that you're in with your meditation. You just are home, you know. And I know my meditations are quite nice. And I just feel a complete feeling of total relaxation and nothing more to do. And it's a wonderful experience. But I think people like Jesus, we read about him, that he went up in the Mount of Olives and prayed for guidance and direction. And from his inner awareness, he was just tuning in. And he went out in the desert 40 days and 40 nights tuning in. Fascinating, isn't it? Really fascinating. No food, no water, no nothing. Amazing man. Now, it can be done. It can be done. But you see, I know it can be done, but I don't go along totally with what we are led to believe about Jesus. Because if Jesus were as far developed as he was, and he was, he did not, what?
Go in the desert.
He did not need water. He did not need food. He did not need these things. He may have gone to the desert as a symbol,
yes,
but he didn't need the stuff. You know, and we, oh, he has to have it. You know, he did without it, you know, and he was amazing to do without it. No, he wasn't. He did without it all the time, a lot of times. I mean, we don't read about the barbecues that Jesus attended, you know. We don't read about all of the food and things that he did, because that wasn't something. Now, in the works of Saint Germain, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Do you read about him eating at banquets and things like that? No, because it wasn't necessary for his survival. It wasn't necessary for his experience. Now, we hear that Jesus went to the dinner of the Sadducees, Pharisees, and the publicans, and all these other people. It doesn't say he ate. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. But that was not said. And but he went among the wine bibbers, you know, people who liked wine. And supposedly he drank it also. But there is not one statement anywhere that I can recall where it says Jesus ate something or that he drank something. And who knows, maybe we missed the point there, you know, of his magnificence, you know, because God cannot be in part in any of us. And when we tune in to our God self and begin to recognize that all the things anyone else has done, even Jesus, we can do too. And that's what he said. But we have a big difficulty in trying to describe something we are not in the position to describe. We are trying to describe another dimension, if you will, of experience, which is the dimension of absolute. And the dimension of absolute encompasses all, but we cannot even comprehend that it encompasses all. Because if we were to see the earth, and we'd say, well, now the earth's a neat thing. Let's make a shell, or a plastic shell, around the earth, maintaining its atmosphere, maintaining its condition in here, so it's always perfect, and keeping out any asteroids or other things, they just bounce off that plastic shell. And then the sun shines when we want it to shine, and the moon shines when we want it to shine, and does the things we want it to do. And, you know, what the heck, we can do that. And with our thought, we just create sunshine, or we just create moonshine, or we just create anything we want. But for us to ever, which we will continue trying to do, for us to ever try to understand absolute in relative words is going to be sort of a farce. It'll be a joke, but it's fun to play the joke. It's just like two people who are madly in love. Why do you love her? I don't know. There's just things you just don't know. And why do you love that character? He always does things to make you unhappy. Oh, I just love him, you know. Well, why? What's he got that somebody else hasn't got? Well, he has a certain charisma. He's got a certain sensitivity. He's got a certain lack of sensitivity. What?
Vibrations.
Yeah, he's got vibrations, all right. That's for sure. And, if I may say, he probably has certain odors about him, you know, like underarm odor and things like that. And according to scientific research that was done on it, that women just go crazy for men's underarm odor.
Ooh.
And I mean, it sounds kind of far out, but they did the research on this, and that when the wife was near the underarm odor, you know, not negatively, but you know, a pleasant amount, she just was in paradise.
Oh, good.
You know, really. What's your favorite perfume? Is your favorite perfume some Chanel, or is it some guy's underarm? You know, and really, this is what the article said. I, of course, had no desire for that feeling, but it was very interesting. And I must always keep these things and let you see them too, because it's so informative. Yes, yes, yes. How can humanity express the archetypal thought of absolute in its pristine form? Ellen, where did you get that statement? I mean, you must have really worked hard to create one that was so unique. But at least we've touched upon it, and we've given a little thought to it. And all the absolute philosopher can do is just philosophize about what comes through. And like I told Irene in her email, I said, Irene, you have the genius within you to write anything you want. And when you start writing, ideas will come to you. And I said, believe in them. Trust them. Follow them. Because they'll be right. If you grab them right away, when they're the first ones. Mm. If you wait a little while, then no way. Mm. No way. And that's what most humanity does. They think about it. Use your head. Think about it. Mm-hmm. But I say, don't think about it. I say, take the first thought that comes to your mind and act upon it, and then you'll be right. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, then you're rationalizing, and pretty soon you've rationalized it all out of the reality that it is. But it's fun, and it's interesting. Well, you have a lovely evening.
Thank you.
And never stop using your imagination on your absolute condition.
That's right.
I love you, I love you, I love you. Yeah.